You're listening to Hillary Simply, and I'm your host, Hillary. In the words of Albert Einstein, I have no special talents. I'm just passionately curious. So let's get curious, unpopular, and honest on endless topics together. And 3, 2, 1, Michael Carino.
Hillary Curry, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Oh, it's Saturday morning. We were just talking about your slippers.
Yes. Got to be comfortable on Saturday morning.
Yes, you do. Working on a Saturday. Well, and we're in your house, a beautiful home.
Thank you.
I'm kind of jealous. It's gorgeous. But that's not really what we're talking about today. I wanted to have you on because I feel like you are extremely driven and probably always have been. And I wanted to know, like, how that, one, what is that? Like, where did that come from, if you had to guess? And two, like, how did that play a role in your family? Because you, from the outside looking in, you guys are extremely tight-knit.
Yes.
And sometimes I fear, probably not always, case in point for you guys, that like being very driven and being very successful can like be really hard to have that tight family that you guys have.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you bring up because there is a, let's call it work goal and life balance.
Yes.
That is very difficult to achieve. And I can't say that I've actually successfully navigated that most of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the latter stage of my life, I probably learned some difficult life lessons that led me to reprioritize my life.
Oh.
And actually very intentionally rebuild our family fiber and structure. So I was, you're probably right. I'm pretty driven, whether it was college, high school, always was an overachiever, always prioritized doing the things outside of my family that were my most important goals. And I probably gave it 110%.
Mm-hmm.
And there was negative time left available to nurture the family environment.
The unit.
I did have one epiphany moment in my life that kind of altered my course. After college, I did go straight into being an entrepreneur and starting businesses, working 80, 100-hour weeks, gone 5 days a week from home. And I did that for many, many years, and we had kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my son was probably about 5 or 6. Can't remember the exact date. I came home from a trip on a Friday night after being gone all week. And my son was with my wife, and I came home, and I usually get a hug and a kiss and my son was standing behind my wife, holding on to her leg, looking at me like I was a stranger.
Oh no.
And it was one of the most devastating emotional moments for me in my life. And
yeah, you seem just a little bit choked up even just talking about it.
Yeah,
now.
It is. It's actually a pretty tough topic. And then in sitting down and talking with my son, he actually expressed that he was scared of me.
Had you become like disciplined dad? Like you kind of,
I was disciplined dad. I was also, always serious and focused and just completely concentrating on everything that I was trying to accomplish and achieve.
Which was what at the time?
Which at the time was trying to build. I was on my second failed business, which is another long story, but
that sounds like a fun one.
And I was running my second business, which it was a software company.
Mm-hmm.
And it just starting up companies just takes a lot of effort, and it takes beyond the call of duty kind of focus and intent, especially when you're doing it, when you're bootstrapping and you don't have capital and you don't have backing and you don't have net worth.
Yes.
So it's a challenging thing, and it requires that kind of focus if you're going to actually come out the other side successfully.
So what would you tell somebody in your shoes, maybe, like looking back?
You know, I think, well, I've got the opportunity to tell somebody. I have my son who's joined the business, who is already demonstrating a driven philosophy in life, probably even beyond mine.
Really?
And he has got to be his desire for life is to accomplish and achieve things that only the handfuls of people ever achieve. He wants to make that kind of impact in the world. And so I can see him dive into everything that he's doing and letting him know and reminding him, say, listen, don't make my mistake. And of course it's hard for someone to live by other people's mistakes.
Yeah. I'm not you. I'm not doing that.
Exactly. So we do, we coach and just say, hey, just keep your peripheral vision focused. You don't necessarily always have to keep your main vision focused, but you just have to remind yourself daily, weekly, monthly that you're doing this for a reason that's well above and beyond the professional goals that you may have in life. And as long as you don't lose track of it, because there are moments, even when you're driving hard and trying to accomplish building businesses or doing any of those things, there are moments of downtime that you get to take a breath and relax. And if you have, and then you keep your personal side in your peripheral vision, then it's not gone. And instead of just totally vegging in those slow periods, you actually can rejuvenate by engaging and re-engaging with everyone that's your support system and your family. And it keeps you close. It keeps them connected. And if you can probably learn to be vulnerable in your way of life, where you're openly capable of sharing deeply at any given moment in time with those around you who love you and support you, it keeps a pretty strong bond, and you can get through it. It's really hard, but you can, and you have to, all of those things need very focused attention. Building your family takes all of your attention. Building a business, all of your attention. So you have to be able to go back and forth between the two.
Was it worth it?
For me, oh my gosh, I wouldn't change anything in my life. I feel everything I've done in my life has led me to this moment. It's something my wife and I tell each other all the time. It's like, would you change anything? We had some really, really hard times, and we had some really great times. Would we eliminate any of the hard times? And then we both come back to the conclusion of,
no,
it's the hard times that really made us who we are. And we feel good about that today.
Yeah, I've been working in Eastern philosophy, and there's, you know, yin and yang, good and bad, good and, or, you know, dark and light. And the philosophy is kind of basically, if you didn't know bad, you wouldn't know good.
Absolutely.
So.
Very true.
Yeah. Makes the good times that much better. So when you said that your son was scared of you, like what, like obviously it clicked for you, but what did you do different?
Oh, that was a big moment in my life that caused me to seek quickly. In my mind, I didn't have months or years to make a shift. Oh, It, because of how important my family was to me and everything I was doing to a great extent, you know, of course was for me, but for them as well. And whether it's showing myself as a role model for my kids, or just simply accomplishing, et cetera. Technical challenges.
I know. I'm not in my normal space. Sorry, Michael. Okay. I'll just hold it. It's fine. We're good.
Okay. I forgot my train of thought, but
I was asking the question about, I know, the dang technical difficulties got us confused. Okay. So I was talking, you said I didn't have the luxury of it being months or years.
Months or years.
They had
you.
To be quick.
That's it.
Yeah.
It had to be quick because my family was everything to me. And to be a foreigner in my own home was a very disturbing moment. Yeah. For me. And it just caused me to reevaluate mm-hmm. who I was and what I was doing and why am I doing this? And a lot of sleepless nights for a little bit. And then I suddenly it just kind of hit me. It's like, this is not who I want to be. Mm-hmm. As much as I want to accomplish some of the things I was doing, I can find a different way to accomplish it. And alter my role in my business, alter the people that are supporting me in my business around me. And I hired some people that could do the travel work that I was doing. Mm-hmm. Even though it was something I loved to do,
yeah.
There were other things that I could find that kept me closer to home that eliminated the travel, which was a big piece of it. It's not coming home every day.
That's rough. Yeah.
It's rough. And seeing your family on the weekends, that's a hard way to build that. So I did that, and I began to make sure that all the extracurricular activities that come with work, that even though they're productive and they help with networking and all kinds of fun stuff, it really wasn't essential. Mm-hmm. And other people in my company could do that so that I could just come home every night and be with my family and partake and not be traveling so that I could then get involved with my kids' little league and my daughter's soccer. And mm-hmm. I just literally made a change. And I did have to accept that my change in priorities could impact whether this business could be successful.
Well, yeah, because now you're relying on somebody else. And my experience of you is like perfectionist maybe a controller. And so not to have like that control over things that you feel like you could probably do better. Mm-hmm. That's you surrendered.
You do. And actually resulted in growth for me. I think one of our biggest challenges as leaders in growing is actually learning how and who to delegate to.
Yes. That's so hard. That's
making that leap because nobody does it better than you in your mind, of course.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Then you learn that actually other people potentially can do it better than you. And it teaches you a lesson that actually allowed a new layer of growth for me professionally. Oh. So this epiphany moment of desiring balance actually resulted in a big bonus at work because it forced me to hire qualified people, put them in the right places, empower them to do it, mm-hmm. not micromanage. And it ended up becoming a win-win where the balance was restored in my life and work took off.
Wow. Well, thank you, Mikey. Now, Mary, your wife, just for everybody listening, she is such a loving, kind woman. Now, when this all happened, was she like, did she play a role in being like, what are you doing? Or was she just letting you experience what was happening?
You know, Mary and I, first of all, we have a kind of relationship because for the most part, we kind of grew up together. I mean, we've known each other since we were 19.
Mm-hmm.
We went through a kid's age, in my mind, college,
mm-hmm. yep.
together, and then post-college. And you do a lot of growing up during those college years and the 2-3 years thereafter. And so we kind of grew up together and got to know each other as great friends first.
Mm-hmm.
it was only later on that our friends kind of clued us in that,
hey, you might maybe be a
we
good
should
fit.
Be thinking something else, which is interesting. But that friendship.
I'm going to go with you were really focused. Eye on the prize, professional.
Pretty much. We were both focused. We were both driven people. Mm-hmm. And so that relationship, that friendship, led us into a mode of dialogue with each other. You know, she never told me what I had to do. Ah. She never expressed that there was only a particular way of being together that was going to be acceptable. It was always a projection of, hey, what's important to you? What's important to me? What's important to us? You know, as a couple, and we would always dialogue it, and then we'd have the conscious conversations. Okay, mm-hmm. Well, we want to build a business. We want to build a future that has unlimited potential for us. Mm-hmm. And so we know that takes hard work. So okay with that, and okay with the focus that is required. Yeah. But she was always that little voice on my shoulder reminding me, yeah, saying, hey, don't forget.
Where's your focus?
What's important? You know, there's got to be a little bit of balance. You don't want to wake up one day and the people that are important around you are no longer around. So she was kind of always that
barometer, like an anchor.
That kept me focused in a very conversational way. Doesn't mean we didn't have our fights here and there.
Of course not.
We didn't have our moments of it's just enough is enough. But yeah, for the most part, that's the way our relationship's been.
That's awesome. I mean, she's fantastic. You're fantastic. I'm blessed to know both of you. So I kind of went a little backwards here, but would you tell my listeners like kind of who you are and what you do for a living?
Sure. I currently am running a sales and marketing company, real estate oriented, residential real estate specifically. Our primary business is to provide sales and marketing solutions for home builders. Mm-hmm. And we have some brokerage style offices where we do traditional residential real estate, but it's an offshoot of the new home business.
Okay.
And so we go and we work with small to mid-sized builders that are not big publicly traded builders that
like Toll Brothers.
Toll Brothers, that all have the economy of scale and infrastructure to build a best-in-class sales and marketing department. Mm-hmm. So that was our business model. Build a best-in-class sales and marketing department of the size, caliber, and quality of what large companies are capable of creating, and then offer in a shared basis to small to medium sized home builders so that they can benefit from the same kind of
exposure. Yes. Yep. That's amazing. And how did you fall into that? Because I know you said that your last business, your words failed business, was tech.
That's correct. Yes. It was a soft. So this was the conclusion of that tech business, that software company. We were a company that was built on client server technology, which you're probably too young to even know what that is.
I'm going to need a refresher.
This is pre-web.
Okay.
Technology.
Okay.
And software where people had internal networks inside their companies and there was no real internet.
That makes sense. Okay.
That was what you ran your business on. And we failed to make that leap from client server to recognizing the internet age. Mm-hmm. Couldn't convince any of my shareholders to make the investment to transition the technology. And so in late 1900s, the late 1990s.
I was like, wow, definitely not that old.
late 1990s, that business failed during the .com
boom
or burst. And I was seeking a different life. It was kind of in burnout mode. High tech can be pretty burnout. It's pretty intense. Mm-hmm. And I had a very, very close friend here in Alamo, a friend of mine at a country club. And he was starting a business.
Oh.
And he had come from, he was an executive in Toll Brothers, and he was starting an outsourced sales and marketing business to help small builders.
Oh.
And that was in the early, probably around 99, 2000. And okay. He just said, hey, you've been doing small business startups for a while. I've never done it. Can you give me some pointers? I went and consulted with him for a summer. And got involved in the selling of a home to a prospect, one of his salespeople. And I helped out just in learning the business. And I had an interesting experience. The salesperson had sold, and I had been somewhat involved in the initial conversation with those buyers mm-hmm. that bought the home. And I ended up volunteering to hand over the keys and welcome them to their new home. And so I went out and I did that. And I had this moment of time where I'm congratulating them, I'm excited for them, and I'm handing them the keys. And the wife broke down and started crying. And she just, more technical difficulty. she started crying on my shoulder, hugging me, thanking me for helping her dreams come true. And it was like this moment of, oh my God, what a special thing. You know, yeah. We all work really, really hard in business. And for most part, everything I'd ever done was dollars and cents.
Mm-hmm. You don't see the consumer.
The rewards. We're all about profits and stocks and stock value. And the next thing I'm realizing is that the big win here was this emotional moment in which you feel like you actually helped change somebody's life for the better.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, oh my God, you can make money and feel this way all at the same time. And so that epiphany led me to get really passionately involved in this consulting I was doing for my friend, which he caught on to. And by the end of the summer, the two of us felt, hey, you know what? We're a pretty good match. He's the real estate expert, done this for a million years. I'm a business, building small business, mm-hmm. more or less expert. I don't know about true expert, but I had done it before.
Yes.
And it's like, why don't we team up? And there's an opportunity here. And I think we can make a pretty special business. And that's how I got started.
Okay. And so just in case, you know, my podcast blows up, what's the name of your company?
Press Group.
Press Group. Yep. And yeah, okay. So future people listening to this, when my podcast blows up, and if you are a small to medium sized home builder and you need advertising, Prez Group.
Thank you, Hillary.
You're welcome. We got a name drop. That's how that works. So then you got into business with him.
Mm-hmm.
And how long did it? I mean, you said late 90s, early 2000s. So you were kind of right before the boom.
Right before the boom. Yeah. So we, that turned out to be a very successful business. We started by the time we hit 2004, which was about 4 years later. I think we were probably serving about 50 home builders up and down the West Coast, predominantly in California. Mm-hmm. Obviously, new construction boom was in high gear.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, I mean, just hundreds of small and mid-size home builders, which don't exist today, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But this was at a time in which, you know, the industry had reached, you know, 3 million new homes a year were being built in the United States at that time. That was our average home build compared to today, which is right around a million. So we're still only about a third of what the peak volume of new home sales
was
before the mini crash in
2007 and 2008. Okay.
So our company grew with that and all these home builders. We had well over 100 agents working for us. Any given moment in time, we were managing 50, 60, 70 communities for sale in multiple markets, and had a pretty large organization. And until the 07, 08, 09 crash.
Okay, so what happened then?
Well, I think as the whole industry, which obviously new construction collapsed significantly during that period of time, our company went from, I don't know, we probably had 140 salespeople. Maybe by the time my partner and I agreed to disagree and we parted companies trying to figure out what is the future, we probably had gone down to about 30.
Wow.
So we're probably looking at about 70 to 80% collapse in our revenue base. So it was fun times.
Oh.
And when we didn't quite agree how to proceed, and our ideas were pretty interesting. It kind of was a similar encounter that happened with me with the high tech firm where we were kind of an old fashioned company with old fashioned technology and we needed to leap to the internet. I couldn't convince the people around me
to make
the leap and make the investment.
Well, and I mean, they're probably in scarcity mode. So they're,
oh, they are.
Like, don't spend too much money. Don't do anything different. Just try to make weather the storm.
Okay. Yeah. And that's the same thing that happened with my partner when the market was crashing. That's what we couldn't agree on. It was, hey, I'm in my mind is like, you know what? I've been here before. Now's the time to double down, reinvent, and move forward. And he wasn't interested in that. He didn't want to reinvent the company and figure out a new business model to come out of the ashes with. And we talked about it for quite a bit and then eventually just parted ways.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just have a question.
Yeah.
Would you say that you feel like the best thing you can do as a business owner who might be starting to drown is to reinvent and kind of double down?
Always. And, you know, I think everything we do is an evolving concept. You know, I don't care how great an idea is when it starts.
Yeah.
It's an idea and concept. Mm-hmm. And how that idea matures is, you know, for me, it needs to be more of a catalyst to launch a purpose. Mm-hmm. That's honestly what an entrepreneurial idea should be.
Right.
And if you keep your eye on the purpose, then you naturally evolve and reinvent forever. It doesn't really stop. But that's hard to do.
Yeah.
To maintain this mode where I'm constantly questioning, is this the way I should be doing things, is hard and it is disruptive.
That's true.
But, and so that's why we kind of come up with great ideas, start a business, run it until it runs out of steam and don't realize sometimes the shifts that you have to make through that process so that it doesn't have to end. It doesn't have to fail. So you just have to keep that in the back of your mind. And then you work hard for weeks, months, reevaluate, rethink, reimagine, keep going. And always with the eye towards what was my purpose? You know, what was the big picture objective of what I was trying to achieve?
What's your purpose?
What's our purpose?
Yeah.
In our company? Or in me as a person?
But I'm going to go both.
Okay. So, and actually, we've gone through a process over the last 3 years with our current purpose for our company.
Okay.
And we've done a little bit of reinventing, actually, over the last 3 years. We had an opportunity in our current business about 3 years ago to buy out my partner. Mm-hmm. And our family bought the rest of the business, which included my kids.
And so, you have like a legacy going.
Yeah. Oh. So they joined the business. They bought into the business. They joined the business. And then jointly together as a family, we decided to sit down and rethink, well, what is our purpose? Why are we doing this? What are we trying to accomplish? And actually, and I thank my kids for it, we ended up settling on a great mission statement. So our mission statement as a company defines our purpose. We help people make real estate decisions that profoundly improve their lives. So that's the purpose of our company.
Improving
life through home ownership. And so everything we do is to support people in moving their lives forward in a manner through the housing that they choose to change their lives for the better. And
wow.
When you do that, it's interesting when your purpose is good or great. Mm-hmm. And you learn to do that well, the rewards, the professional rewards, the financial rewards, et cetera, they just seem to happen.
Well, what I find interesting about your mission statement is technically you're the advertising firm that supports the builder who creates the home, but you don't stop at serving, like your mission statement doesn't stop at serving the builder. It stops
at serving the builder's client.
Yes.
The customer.
The people.
Mm-hmm.
That's
amazing.
And
we found having that mission statement on behalf of our clients helps create a persona for them, a representation for them, that creates an enhanced image for them as well. Mm. We're in charge with representing them as a seller, as a builder to their customers and creating a business model that makes people think that they care about them, mm-hmm. and that what they're doing, what they're building, what they're selling, how they create their process is in order to facilitate that process, makes the builder more successful too. So it becomes kind of a win-win-win. We all feel good about what we're doing. The customer's winning, our client's winning, and then there's financial rewards that kind of get shared around and everybody does well.
Bonus. Yeah. It sounds like essentially that your mission statement and your purpose is embedded in every product that you put out there.
Mm-hmm.
Like underneath that company's own mission statement or purpose. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what's your purpose as an individual?
Oh, my purpose. You caught me here because I actually haven't really.
It's probably changed.
Thought about it in a little bit. We've been so focused, and you know what? I think right now, I'm being driven by a purpose through our business. It's funny; it always kind of comes back down to that. But we spend so much time doing what we do professionally.
Well, now your family is involved too. So
yeah, that. You know, you want that part of your life, which is the biggest part of your life, to be profoundly rewarding, mm-hmm. not just rewarding. It's not just a job for us. It has become a lifestyle. So creating something that can last and become a legacy, that survives me, that continues to pay off to the family, even after I'm gone, is an exciting proposition. So I think that's kind of become my new purpose.
It's creating a legacy for your children, your grandchildren, mm-hmm. your grandchildren's children.
Yep. Yep. And you know, I've got a lot of examples in my life through my whole life, but probably the most significant that affected my thought process in that, and that made me real happy when my kids joined, is actually having watched my wife's family do the same thing. You know,
yes.
My wife being in the, her family being in a chocolate business that started, I don't know, I think it was 87 years ago.
87 years. So in the 1900s?
Yes. Yeah. But it, and so it supported four generations in a manner and lifestyle that was so wonderful. And I benefited from it. And
I've eaten the chocolate. I've benefited from it.
Yes, that's a fact. The chocolate was definitely a bonus.
So amazing.
But the lifestyle that it produced and it afforded not just the core people, the her grandfather and her dad and eventually her brother and so on and so forth, they afforded an opportunity to an entire family across an entire country to achieve dreams. And so creating that is something special. And so that's become it.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And sorry, I'm just in thought here. So your legacy, leaving behind a business that takes care of generations so that they can live their dreams. Where do you think like your ambition came from, your drive? Like, was it innate? Was your dad that way? Like,
well, listen, my parents, came from that heads down, hardworking, generation that just, to a certain extent, almost, it was work for work's sake. There was that whole work hard mentality, and it didn't have as much of the that this is important. It's just this is what you did. Mm-hmm. You worked hard. You put food on the table.
You're 9 to 5.
You moved on, and you did the 9 to 5. And I watched my dad work through a banking career that. It provided decently for us. You know, it probably didn't provide the lap of luxury. And, you know, I didn't ever get to see them and enjoy their life probably the way we enjoy our life. They were okay with it. I mean, I don't know. You know, they were a different generation and a different mindset.
Yes.
And probably didn't miss it as much. Even now, it's hard for them to enjoy the things that we do, and they kind of think and look at it and say, really, you're going to go on a second vacation this year?
Right. You're like, every other week if I can.
Yeah, thanks. If we can, that's what we're here for. Oh, okay. Have fun. Yeah. You know, and it's so that I just hit the
technical difficulties again.
Did I? Hopefully I didn't move it. But yeah, so I saw that, and then there was a moment in time in my dad's life. They made a decision when I was in junior high, I was in eighth grade, that, and they came from South America and they wanted me to experience.
Oh, I want to hear more about that.
My culture. And they had always had in the back of their minds, hey, do we go back one day? You know, was there one of those immigrants that came in the early 60s? Well, 1960, to the United States, looking for a
better tomorrow.
And worked real hard. And there was a moment in time where we had an opportunity and they took it. And we went to live back in South America. And I was there for 3 years. I did my first three years in high school in South America. And he moved there. He quit his banking job. And what propelled the opportunity was an ability to start a dairy distribution business with a cousin that had called him up and said, come back to South America, Chile, and help me build this business. And, you know, the income, even if you're a moderately income person here, taking your money from here and going to South America has made you in a much better position in South America.
Yes.
And so he found this opportunity. Hey, let me take my savings. I'll go. I'll help start that business. And I had a period of 3 years. You know, the volatility of government and politics eventually drove us back. Mm-hmm. But I watched my dad get involved in building a business with a family member. And I discovered a new dad. There was this passion and thrill and excitement. And is like, he's up before his alarm and he's getting dressed and I'm going in early. And he was just so excited to be doing what he was doing. And it just resonated with me. It just sat as like, I want to be like that. I want to be that person that loves their family, pays attention to their family, but
they're equally excited
going to work and doing what they're doing. And so that entrepreneur bug is like, okay, what do I need to do to be that? And that kind of lit a spark. So and it's like, okay, I'm going to study hard. I'm going to get my good grades. I'm going to do sports. I'm going to do things in ways that I can prove that I'm capable, because I came from a family without a lot of wherewithal. So I was judging myself early on that, you know, I can do more, I can do better than this kind of a thing. Work harder, be better. And it just put me into a mindset that changed my life.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Now you said it was in Chile. Are you Chilean then?
I am. Okay. I was born in Chile.
That was going to be my next question. Were you born in the United States or? Yeah. So you are an immigrant.
I'm an immigrant.
Technically.
At 10 months old.
Right? So you've known no other life, but technically.
Mm-hmm.
What's that like? Was it weird growing up and having, or do you feel like everybody kind of around you was similar? Like,
yeah, you know, I knew technically that I was perceived immigrant, even though I didn't sound or act immigrant, I certainly looked immigrant. And people that met my parents, there was accents and all that kind of stuff. And so I actually did struggle with that in my early days in elementary school. I was always, you know, made fun of for, you know, quote unquote, being perceived either Mexican or Hispanic or whatever. And, you know, so I experienced a little bit of discrimination in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Kids are mean.
They are. They're just mean. And if it wasn't that, they would have probably found some other way to make fun of me, but that's right. Okay. You know, we all go through that in life. Yeah. And it helped form a lot of who I am today too, you know? And, but that actually, and some people that ignites, it shuts you down. Mm-hmm. And in some people, it seems to be a spark.
I'll show you.
To achieve anyway.
And yes,
despite it. So for me, for whatever reason, it manifested itself into a, you know,
I'll show
everyone.
Yeah.
I'm better than that.
I think you did. So. I mean, I'm no expert, but I think you did pretty good.
Well, thank you.
Oh my gosh. So what was the, I'm assuming, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, because you immigrated from Chile to the United States, did you have to become a U.S. citizen or are
you? I didn't have to, no. When my parents came at first, they just got green cards and we were permanent alien residents.
Got it. Okay.
Of the United States for a long time. And we did quite a bit of travel back and forth to Chile. Mm-hmm. So I would go for the summers. You know, we would spend a few months and then come back. And so there were rules back then that said you had to be in the country for it with no breaks for 5 years, with no breaks greater than 90 days in order to do your citizenship. And so I kept ruining my 5-year window. And eventually yeah, to hell with it. I'm not going to keep trying. And I did eventually become a citizen, but it wasn't until after college. And
when you got married?
After I got married. No, not because I got married, but after I got married. No, it just, getting married to someone who's a U.S. citizen won't make you a citizen. It just lets you stay in the country.
Does it make it easier, do you think?
I don't know. I don't think it actually helped. The questions and things that they ask to become a citizen isn't that, but
I feel like I've heard that sometimes they ask questions on those tests or forms that a lot of U.S. citizens wouldn't know the answer to.
I'm telling you, I agree with that. It's like, you know, I ran around how much I had to study to be able to pass that test. And I'd lived since I was 10 months old in the United States, went to all U.S. schools and learned everything that every kid learns. And there was no way I would have passed 20% of those questions had I not studied for months ahead of time.
Wow.
And I think it's a great thing though, because it, you know, you want to be conscious of what shouldn't be becoming a U.S. citizen just because you want to be a citizen. You should know what you're getting into, mm-hmm. why you're getting into, what are the principles of our country and our government and our philosophy of life? And I should be agreeing to that.
Yeah. Sounds like everybody needs to take this test.
I would agree. Yeah. I would agree. I wish they did more of that.
It's like a U.S. aptitude test.
We'd all be much more proud of our country,
I think. I think you're right. So what was it like? Obviously, there was a time period where you couldn't vote, I assume.
Oh, yeah.
But were...
That was probably the biggest factor to get me to get my citizenship once and for all. Because when I was a highly active, politically minded person in college. Mm-hmm. Now, I went to University of San Francisco, so it was a pretty Democrat-type environment.
Yes.
Which typical in California.
Right.
And I was a conservatively minded person, came from a conservatively minded family.
Okay.
And so when I got to USF, I was like, okay, well, that's a Democrats club over there. And where's the Republican club? Is there a Republican club anywhere? And I'm looking around. It's like talking to everybody. And I'm getting all these cockeyed looks like,
who are you? What are you
talking about?
Yeah.
You know, and
you're also an immigrant. Why aren't you over here thinking this way?
So I started a college Republican club and
did you really
at the university and went out and found a bunch of peers that had similar conservative beliefs as I did. And it kind of sent me into this mode of, maybe I'll think about politics. Maybe that's what I want, because I really enjoyed participating and creating that. That club, and it opened up a whole new set of doors and lifestyles to think about. Was eventually by that little voice that was on my shoulder that became my wife, eventually convinced that the political life was not for me.
I mean, she probably did you a favor.
She did for sure. Did me a favor. anyway, so thinking about having a political career, I'm like, well, I better be a U.S. citizen if I'm going to embark down this road. I can't go as a complete foreigner.
Yeah, no, you gotta have a little something.
And I didn't see that myself that way. And actually, I kind of felt that I was more American than a lot of people I knew that were born here.
You probably were. I hate to say that as a U.S. citizen, but you probably were. A lot of people have no idea. They don't care. They don't care to vote. Like,
yep. And they don't necessarily believe in our lifestyle and our and our philosophy of life and politics and government. And so that led me to say, let's take a political route and let's get our U.S. citizenship done. And eventually I did get it done.
That's amazing. Oh my God. I feel like you're like the American dream.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I think you are. I mean,
I'm just a guy enjoying life who learned early on with some good mentorship and good role models in my life to just be purposeful about what I do and why I do it. And it's helped me.
I feel like I need to sit down now and have create my purpose.
I would encourage anybody to do that.
Okay. Yeah.
And even if you define it a certain way today, it will evolve.
It should.
But at least it'll be intentional. You'll be heading in a direction with your life that, and an outcome that you actually took control of.
Yeah. Because otherwise, what's the goal or what's the reason?
What's the reason? And, you know, I don't want things to happen to me by accident. I get that happens.
Yeah.
And sometimes the by accident stuff, you're lucky mm-hmm. and it's by accident good stuff. Sometimes it's by accident not so good stuff. Mm-hmm. And when you're purposeful, it really helps one, more of the good things that you want to have happen. Mm-hmm. And it actually reduces how many things happen to you that you really don't want happening.
Well, yeah, and I imagine when they do, that it's easier to get through when Absolutely. You see the purpose.
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh, I love this conversation. So being that you have owned several companies and now are here with your family and you have this team of people, like how do you lead? Like, if you had to put some words to the type of leader you are or what's important to you and your team members, what is that?
From the priorities in what I try to give back to my company and people is to help them in kind of in a mentoring kind of way, mm-hmm. identify and their purpose, both within the company, outside the company.
Like, do you have them write their own purpose, like mission statement? Okay.
We actually ask our people to define what their purpose within the company is, mm-hmm. what their personal mission is, identify all of the things in common that can support it, identify if there's any personal versus professional purpose that are in complete conflict that may cause them to rethink purpose. Is if we don't have alignment in it, that's kind of where one, you eventually won't be successful.
Yeah. And red flag.
And you won't be as productive and as good at what you do. Hmm. So we believe that if your purposes are in alignment, productivity is exponentially greater. Mm-hmm. The happiness factor, how much I enjoy what I'm doing, goes up exponentially. And we all feel good about it.
Yeah. And
so we actually, in fact, I'll thank my kids again because they drove the effort. We actually created a culture task force in the company.
What?
They drove.
Is a culture task force. I need you to break that down for me.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a task force comprised of leadership and members of every department to come together and say, our goal in life is not to decide what we do or how we do it. It's who are we?
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
That's their goal.
Yeah.
So who are we as a company? If somebody was to describe our company, our goal was that they would describe them with characteristics that they might actually describe a person.
Oh.
Right? We want, when people do business with us, we want them to think in terms of personal characteristics. Are they honorable? Do they have integrity? Do they have purpose? Mm. Are we kind? Are we generous? Are we, what are we?
Yeah.
Who are we? Not what do we do? So, right, we sell homes, we do real estate transactions, we do marketing, mm-hmm. but none of those things define who we are. Mm-hmm. And so if you can overlay that who we are, you begin to define purpose. So we try to help everyone within the company do that professionally and personally and create alignment with it. And then the culture task force was then intended to come up with what are the predominant key characteristics that we ultimately want our behavior to reflect. Not that we have a plaque on a wall that says, here are the value words that we all believe in. We don't want to put it on the wall.
You want to live it.
We want our behavior to make people think that.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
So, and that's what the culture task force is about. So creating mechanisms like that, creating opportunity, doing that kind of mentoring, inspiring people for greater purpose, which breeds success. And then the other thing is removing obstacles. You know, it's, I don't do anything in the company other than help remove the obstacles of success for everybody else in the company. And that's what I see my role is as a leader.
Wow. Yeah, I think when you, at least my experience of owning a business, I think you start out by thinking that, you know, you have to do all the things, do all the things. And then you kind of quickly learn sometimes the hard way that really your biggest job is to inspire people.
It is.
And for, I think you fight, well, again, my experience, you kind of battle the people at first and you're like trying to manage them and don't do this and do that. And then when you realize the sweet spot is inspiring them to do the work, the job is really your main goal.
Yep. Well, and I discovered pretty early on through some of those key moments in my life that there's probably always somebody who can do that task better than I can.
Yep.
And if you can line up a bunch of people that can do all these tasks better than you can, and you can let them do it and remove obstacles from them achieving it, performance and productivity goes way up, is by staying out of the way.
Yes, that's very true. Is there one job that you can't and don't want to give up?
Yeah. The one I struggle with the most, eventually, the relationships that I've built with my clients.
Oh, yeah. I like seeing you.
like you and your husband and your family is one of the most rewarding parts of the work that I do. Mm-hmm. And sharing that with those individuals, losing that. If we were to grow and get a lot bigger and we were to have dozens or hundreds of clients, I won't be able to do that as much. I'll probably still maintain a few of those relationships just because I love it so much and it's so rewarding to me to participate in that manner. But I can't manage the company and manage our clients as well. So that's a conflict.
That'll be the hard one to give up.
That'll be the hard one. So I won't give it up altogether.
But yeah.
A lot of it.
You'll give them the new ones that you don't know yet.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh, Michael, thank you so much. Do you have anything else that you want to share or that you feel like might be important to, you know, people that might be in your shoes now?
Important to people? I don't know.
Other entrepreneurs or...
Other entrepreneurs.
Fathers even.
Oh, yeah. Well, entrepreneurs and as fathers, I just reiterate, keep that peripheral vision going and make sure that the non-entrepreneurial ideas around your life that are important stay in focus.
Keep your purpose.
Keep the balance. Keep your purpose. Know what your personal purpose is. Know what your professional purpose is. And make sure they're in alignment, that one isn't going to collapse the other.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being on today. I really enjoyed this. Thanks for talking to me.
It's fun.
All right. Now you'd have to say your last name as intended. I don't think I say it.
Michael Carreño in the United States.
Uh-huh.
Michael Carreño.
Carreño. Okay. Oh, my R's. Carreño.
There you go.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Hillary.
If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a comment or like. If you'd like to see video content of this episode, follow us on our YouTube channel, Hillary Simply. And as always, stay passionately curious.